You're 10 years old on a one-week road trip from Anchorage, Alaska, through Canada, Montana, and Wyoming, to the plains of southeast Colorado. You've got the captain's chair of a 1991 GMC Astro. It's the height of luxury right there. Your younger brother's got the other captain's chair, and your two little sisters have the back bench. There's enough space that you can lean the chair back and put your feet up on the window to stretch your legs and fall asleep if you want to. Your only entertainment for this lengthy road trip is a 10-inch TV with a built-in VCR that's strapped in between the driver's seat and the passenger seat, or whatever you can come up with to draw with your colored pens in a notebook. Your dad has aspirations of camping out every night, but it's September. Not a great time of year to camp the Alaska Highway or the Yukon countryside. So you end up staying the night in motels where the water smells strongly of copper. Your dad is driving the U-Haul with all the family's possessions. Your mom's driving the van. And your grandma's in the passenger seat since she came up from Colorado to help with the move. You're leaving all your friends, but your family is together, and that's what's important. That was me, well over 20 years ago. If you've ever been pulled from a place that felt like home, you know how disorienting and even isolating that can be. As a 10-year-old, I had spent half my life in Alaska. So when we finally reached our destination, the arid plains of southeast Colorado, it was a shocking adjustment. In the summer, Anchorage is a nice temperate 70 degrees all day long. Even in September, southeast Colorado gets into the 90s. And it's so dry there that instead of sweating, I remember that when I would step outside, my skin would just kind of prickle and get itchy, like all the sweat was just evaporating as soon as it came out. Everything there is dry and brown and flat, and rarely is there a cloud in the sky. There's this single big hill, I put a picture of it there, in the entire plain called Two Buttes, and the locals call it a mountain, which, after living in Anchorage, I knew was absurd. That's not a mountain. That's just a big hill. And there were so few people. My grandparents' house is out in the country. We rarely went into town, and there were no kids at the church that we went to. I had my siblings, but the loneliness was still intense. Not long after we arrived, my dad left to go to Denver to find a job and a place for the family to live. But the rest of us stayed behind in this strange, dry place. My dad did find a job and a place to stay, but we didn't join him. It was 6 long months before our family was together again. While my parents were separated, we got a puppy. It was a yellow border collie mutt, a lot like that one. In the midst of that instability and loneliness, it was good to have something outside myself that I could put my attention on. My grandpa's yard, I remember, was the one patch of green in the entire plains. It doesn't look very green there. He kept it meticulously watered and trimmed, and there was this one towering tree in the backyard. It was taller than the house, taller than the little antenna tower outside the house. It even seemed like it was taller than the machine shop he kept all his equipment in. That yard and that tree was kind of like a little oasis. I remember laying in the shade of that tree with my puppy. He dozed, as puppies often do, and I just stroked his back, and admired the way that the sunlight dappled his fur through the leaves of the trees. That moment gave me a taste of peace and stability when everything around me was instability and pain. At the time, I wouldn't have said that I felt God with me. I don't think I was thinking much about God at all, to be honest. But looking back, I'm convinced that he was with me in that season and in every difficult season of my life since. Whether I felt him or not, he was there. Maybe your story isn't a move across the country, but you know that feeling. The moment when something shifts and everything is not the way that it was. Maybe someone you cared about deeply died, maybe even suddenly. Maybe it was a divorce. Watching a relationship that you thought would last forever come to an end. Or maybe it was a diagnosis that changed the future that you thought you had. Cancer, multiple sclerosis, kidney failure. Maybe it was the loss of a job or the end of a career dream. Maybe it was a betrayal that you never saw coming. Or maybe it wasn't one big moment. Maybe it was just been a slow drift. A once vibrant friendship that's become dull and disconnected. The exhaustion of carrying burdens that no one else can see. A faith that doesn't feel as real as it used to. A quiet, persistent sense that something is off. Whatever it is, every person in this room, all of us, knows what it is to feel alone, even in a crowd. Sooner or later, life leaves a mark on all of us. One of the heroes of the Bible was a shepherd boy named David, who became a king. Now, David did great things for God, and he led a rich and a meaningful life. But he also knew loneliness and pain, some of which I would say, honestly, was self-inflicted. While he was still a shepherd boy, David was handpicked by God to be the next king of Israel. Saul, the king before him, took him in and mentored him. David faithfully served Saul, leading his armies to battle after battle, to victory after victory. Now, normally Saul's son Jonathan would have been the next king. You might think that God handpicking David to be the king instead would have made Jonathan jealous and spiteful towards David. Not at all. Instead, Jonathan and David became best friends. Jonathan gifted David with his royal robes and armor almost as soon as they met. As David had more and more success leading Saul's armies, Saul began to fear him and hate him. Before long, Jonathan warned David that Saul was planning to have him killed, and he helped David escape. When Saul found out, he nearly killed Jonathan in rage, his own son. In one of the darkest seasons of David's life, Jonathan protected him, encouraged him, and believed in him. When you find a friend like this, hold on to them tight. Friends that are this loyal are very rare. But David still had to flee for his life. For years, he slept in caves and hid in the wilderness, never fully sure if he would see his friends and family again, unsure who he could trust. Imagine the emotional confusion of that. At first, he's adored and celebrated by Israel and Saul. And then he's hiding in dark caves, listening for footsteps, wondering if this is the night that he dies. Years went by, and finally, Saul died in battle against foreign invaders. And his sons, including Jonathan, died on the battlefield with him. One of the few people who made David feel less alone, his best friend Jonathan, was suddenly gone. But that was far from the end of grief in David's life. Years later, David learned what it was to beg God for a miracle and not receive the answer that he wanted. When his newborn son became sick, David spent days fasting and praying, lying on the floor, begging for God to save his child's life. His servants became afraid to even speak to him because they could see how shattered he already was. And then the child died. But that wasn't the end of David's experiences with life, grief, and family strife. Later, his oldest son, the heir to the throne, Amnon, became so entitled that he had no qualms about destroying the lives of his siblings to satisfy his desires, earning the hatred of his siblings. David imposed no consequences on Amnon. He set no boundaries. Instead, he let the resentment simmer between his children for years. David's other son, Absalom, he watched all of this happen. He watched the pain echoing through his family. And he watched as his father, David, refused to act. And bitterness grew inside him. For 2 years, the resentment simmered beneath the surface until finally it boiled over. And Absalom arranged for his brother Amnon to be murdered during a feast. In a shocking turn of events, David imposed no consequences on Absalom either. A few months ago, Michael talked about discipline and grace as two ends of a spectrum. This story is a sobering illustration of what happens when love refuses to confront destructive behavior. Our kids need to know that people do not exist for their pleasure, and that is a lesson we have to start teaching them when they are young. As the years went by, Absalom began quietly turning the people against his father David. He would stand near the city gates as people would come to bring their grievances to his father. And he would tell them, "My father, he doesn't care about your problems. I do. I care about your problems. I'll help you. The king has failed you. David has failed you." Slowly, he stole the loyalty of the kingdom from his own father. Eventually, David realized that Jerusalem was no longer a safe place for him. So he fled, barefoot, weeping, his head covered in grief and humiliation. Imagine the heartbreak of that moment. David, the king of Israel, had faced literal giants, armies, and years of exile. But now, one of the deepest wounds in his life came from inside his own family. And even after Absalom murdered David's son, betrayed him, humiliated him, and tried to destroy him, David still loved his son Absalom. So when Absalom died in battle, David did not rejoice in victory. He collapsed in grief. "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom." The man after God's own heart knew profound sorrow. This man, David, led a life deeply impacted by pain and darkness. From these experiences of life with God, he wrote Psalm 139. "You have searched me, Lord, and you know me." The word for know is not just an awareness of facts. It is a personal, relational knowledge. David is saying here in this first verse that God knows everything about him and understands it from the inside out. God has been with him through every moment of his life. And all along the way, God has seen into him. God knows even the parts of him that he doesn't know himself. You might know what it's like to be lonely, to feel like no one understands you, no one knows who you really are. David is saying that even though that can feel true, it's the opposite. God knows who you are. God understands you, and you've never been alone. Nothing you've done has been hidden from him. No mistake you've made, no tear you've shed, no wound you've suffered. God has been with you through all of it. "You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you, Lord, know it completely. You hem me in behind and before, and you lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. God knows not just your innermost being. He understands you. He also knows all your outermost being, your outermost expressions of who you are. Sitting and rising, going out, lying down. These are mundane things. You do these things every day. But God notices them, and he knows them. Think about how ordinary these examples are. Sitting down, standing up, going to work, going to sleep. David is describing the moments that many of us usually think are too small, too insignificant, too unimportant for God to care about. Most of your life is made up of these ordinary moments: driving to work, folding a basket of laundry, sitting in traffic, studying for an exam, walking in to yet another doctor's appointment, getting some exercise, packing lunches, trying to stay awake in the fifth meeting of the day, lying awake at 2 a.m. because your mind just won't quiet down. And this psalm says God is present with you in all of it. Not just the big dramatic moments, not just the church services like today, not just the life-changing tragedies. God is present in our ordinary Tuesdays. In verse 4, David says, God is familiar with all his ways. Not just his victories, not just the moments where he felt spiritually strong. All his ways. All. God is familiar with you. The word here that's used for familiar carries the idea of a deep acquaintance. This is a personal familiarity. God is not just observing you from a distance. God knows the patterns of your life so intimately that nothing about you is foreign or new to him. He is used to you. Throughout the psalm, David conveys that God's knowledge of you is not a cold, observational kind, but a deeply personal care. The point of these first six verses altogether is that God doesn't just know you in some academic sense. God can recite facts about you better than anyone else, sure. But more than that, he knows you like someone who lives with you and cares about you and your life. He sees how you live. He sees what you go through. He sees the choices that you make, and he sees what those choices do to you. And he cares about all of it. This knowledge leaves David with a question. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there, your hand will guide me, your right hand will hold me fast. God is always with you. You may not always be aware of his presence. Sometimes you may feel alone or far from him, but he is there whether you feel him or not, whether you seek him or not. Whether you are living right or not, God is always seeking you out, and he is always present with you. I won't pretend that I have always felt God with me in hard times. There have been seasons where God has felt very far away from me. But over time, I've come to understand that he was never absent, even if it felt that way to me at the time. God's hand has always guided me. His right hand has always held me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me, and the light become night around me, Even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. Darkness here in this passage is not merely an absence of light, but it can also be interpreted as fear, suffering, the unknown. So David imagines here that he is totally covered in darkness, whether a literal darkness or a metaphorical darkness of pain and uncertainty. And he imagines that in that darkness he is far from God. But then he realizes the darkest situation is not too much for God. When you feel hidden from him, he is still there and he still sees you. Some darkness comes from circumstances that are outside our control. Grief, loss, betrayal, sickness. Some darkness comes from wounds that you carry for years. An anxiety that never seems to quiet down. Shame that you don't know what to do with. A loneliness that you try to hide from other people. And some darkness even comes from your own decisions. The things you regret. The ways you've hurt people. The seasons where you drift from God and you're just not sure how to find your way back to him. But David says, even the darkness will not be dark to God. There is no degree of darkness in your life, whether you create it through your poor decisions or whether it's inflicted on you by circumstances. None of it is too much for God to reach through and be with you. The things that blind and overwhelm you do not blind and overwhelm God. Sometimes you lose your bearings and you lose sight of God, but he never loses sight of you. I went through a very difficult season several years ago when my parents divorced. Even as an adult, it affected me much more deeply than I expected. I could barely hold myself together through the workday. After a few weeks like that, I took a leave of absence from work. I just was not functioning well, emotionally or mentally. It felt like something foundational in my life had broken apart. I spent a lot of time during that season praying, thinking, walking, and even just sitting on a park bench with my eyes closed, listening to the birds, just processing what I was going through. I grew a lot in that season. I became stronger and more able to weather the many difficult seasons that followed it. Because let me tell you, there are many difficult seasons in life. Sometimes it seems like they just keep coming. But in my experience, if you can lean into them, you can learn and become stronger. And the ones that follow become just a little bit easier to bear. Or you can wallow in self-pity, but there's no growth in that. I've been there. I've done that. And I'm through with it. I've learned that self-pity is the opposite of growth. But most importantly in that season, I came to understand on a very personal level that God had not abandoned me to that darkness. He was with me then. Just like he was with me as a boy in my grandparents' yard with my dog. Just like he is with me now. Just like he is with you now. This is exactly what David is sharing in Psalm 139. The darkness is real, but God is still there. Most of us won't feel God's presence with us all the time. I certainly don't always feel God with me. But feeling God isn't the point. You can't control your feelings anyway. So control your attention. Find little ways to remind yourself that God is with you. We're only studying the first 12 verses of Psalm 139 today, but I encourage you to go home and read the whole thing, even spend some time exploring the Psalms more broadly. We have Bibles at the back. They look just like this. You can take one home with you. You can take one and give it to a friend if you need to. One of the things I love about the Psalms is how honest they are. In the Psalms, you find joy, gratitude, grief, fear, anger, confusion, loneliness, repentance, hope. Sometimes the psalmist is praising God, and sometimes he's crying out, asking where God is, because he doesn't feel like he's there. Somewhere in the Psalms, there's a psalm for what you're going through. The Psalms remind us that, more than that, God can handle the truth about what we're feeling, about what we're going through. He can take it. Throughout the day, talk to God like he's a friend who cares about the details of your life, because that's who he is. God, please help me to pay attention in this class. I'm so tired. God, please give me the words to say in this difficult conversation. God, thank you for that breeze that just cooled me down. It is so hot today. That's it. Prayers don't have to be long and complex. Just talk to God. The goal of prayer is not manufacturing spiritual feelings inside yourself. The goal is learning to live in the presence of a God who is already there, to be attentive to that. Remind yourself, God is with me. Repeat it when things get dark. God is with me. At every meal, I pray with my family, Father, thank you for always being with us. And every night when I put my kids to bed, I pray a blessing over them. And as part of that blessing, I say, help them to know that you are always with them. And they can talk to you anytime about anything. These are little things, but they are reminders to me and to my family of the truth. God is present. He is here. He's always in reach. He is faithful even when I am not faithful to him. God is not a petty father, one who makes me come begging to him because it's been too long since you've talked to him, or because you messed something up. No. He's always here, always with his arms open to hold you and his ears open to listen to what you have to say. As the worship team comes back to the stage and we close with the Eucharist, take a few moments. Think back on the dark times in your life. Where can you see God's presence with you? Or maybe you or someone you know or someone you care about is in a dark season right now. Bring that to God. For me, the Eucharist is a tangible reminder of God's grace being present with me in spite of my imperfections, my distractions, my failures to seek him. God gives me his grace, and he is present with me, even in seasons when I am not attentive to him. As you take the bread, you dip it into the wine, and take it into your body, remind yourself, God is with me. Christ's presence is with me. Take that presence with you as you leave today. One way I've learned to pray this awareness of God's presence is through an old prayer attributed to St. Patrick. Pray with me. Christ with me. Christ before me. Christ behind me. Christ in me. Christ beneath me. Christ above me. Christ on my right. Christ on my left. Christ where I lie. Christ where I sit. Christ where I arise. Christ in the heart of everyone who thinks of me. Christ in the mouth of everyone who speaks to me. Christ in every eye that sees me. Christ in every ear that hears me. Salvation is of the Lord. Salvation is of the Christ. May your salvation, Lord, be ever with us. Respond to God at the table today.